I differ from everybody else in how I look at all these things. When you see a China, for example, selling dollars, you know, they maintain a currency peg, which means that when people want to buy your currency, you have to issue more. And when people want to sell your currency, you have to buy your currency back by selling dollars. And so in the ferocious rush to dump the Chinese yuan by the Chinese people, the Chinese People's Bank of China is obliged to buy their currency back to prevent it from utterly crashing. So no, I do not see this as a lack of confidence in the dollar. I see this as the destruction of trust of the yuan.
Good day, everybody. Today, I am joined by Dr. Keith Weiner, founder and CEO of Monetary Metals, a company reimagining gold as a yield-bearing asset. And Keith is one of the sharpest minds on money.
Thanks for having me on the show, Steve.
Well, Keith, what in the world is going on? I mean, what is going on with the global monetary system? Are we looking at an end of a cycle, another turn? What's next for the world economy, and what's it look like getting there?
I think in really broad terms, we're looking at late-stage central bankism, late-stage irredeemable currencyism. So in a normal world, if the governments don't try to take everything over, you know, you deposit money in the bank, money being metal, and you have the right to get back that amount, plus the agreed upon interest. And then when central banks take over, then they confiscate the metal and say, okay, a bank deposit isn't metal anymore. Now it's irredeemable. And that's going to be great because we can centrally plan the economy. We can shove more money down everybody's, what we'll call money, if not, more money down everybody's faces when we want to, and we can monkey with interest rates, and we can do all these things because it'll be more better. Yeah. And you do juice up GDP. GDP is a great measure of the economy if you're a socialist and you want to emphasize consumption rather than savings, because no, GDP adds production plus destruction, right? So if the government, you know, creates what they call money out of thin air and spends it on a welfare program, pisses it down the welfare drain, that adds to GDP. As various Keynesians have said, including Paul Krugman, you know, if you pay 1,000 guys to dig a hole and then you pay 1,000 other guys to fill it in, that adds to GDP. Now, that doesn't mean that we should do that. That just means GDP is a terrible measure of the economy, but it serves the central bankers very well because they can juice up, you know, GDP with their policies. The problem is you add more and more and more debt. It isn't money printing. It's actually money borrowing or credit. It's a credit issuance of some sort. And you have more and more and more of this bad credit, which has to be serviced. It's all fun and games until somebody misses a payment. It all has to be serviced, and that drags down the economy more and more and more, and the economic, the structure of production becomes more and more distorted, more and more away from the things that people need and more towards the things that benefit from cheap, easy credit, such as housing, you know, being an obvious one. And then eventually you have a bust, you go through a lot of cycles, booms and busts, the interest rate is a secular falling trend since 1981, approximately. And what I think is going to happen now is the interest rate will resume that falling trend with a vengeance, regardless of whether the central bank wants it or not, regardless of whether the president wants it or not. President Trump does want it. So, but he happens to be just pushing along with the grain. That's going to happen anyway. Interest rates went negative again in Switzerland. This is a worldwide, you know, mega trend. So what that means is, think about a negative interest rate. You deposit $1,000 and you get back $990. Now, that wouldn't work under gold because you just simply withdraw the gold. But because you're a paper, there's very little point in withdrawing the paper. Now, if the interest rate gets negative enough, people withdraw the paper anyway. So then they're going to have to impose central bank digital currencies so that the cash, you know, digital cash will have the same negative rate as the banking system, and there'll be no incentive to withdraw, and then everybody loses. So we're sort of approaching that point.
Keith, I mean, you used the word irredeemable, and you know, ever since the dollar was untethered to anything. I feel like it's been a ticking time bomb for future generations to deal with. Is there any way for us to unscramble the egg here? I mean, are we, is there a point of no return? You know, kind of the wheel's been set in motion and there is, I guess, an Armageddon, if you will, a breaking point. What's that look like? And is there anything that can be done except to brace for impact?
Well, not inside the dollar system itself. You can't retroactively declare an irredeemable credit to say, well, now it's gold back. None of the dollars that exist sloshing around, you know, trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars sloshing around the world today began life as a gold deposit. So you can't pretend as, oh, well, now it's a gold deposit. No, it isn't. It's irredeemable. And one of the fatal flaws of an irredeemable currency system is the debt grows exponentially. It must grow exponentially. So, you know, if you talk in terms of, are you looking for, you know, what's the point of no return? I think there are probably several. One of which is what happens when the debt gets ludicrously beyond the point where it could ever be repaid. $37 trillion. And if you assume about 100 million people working in the private sector, I mean, even if people in the public sector, even if you concede that they're productive, they can't pay the debt on that because they're being paid by government. 100 people working in the private sector, 100 million people working in the private sector, $37 trillion in debt. That means $370,000 debt burden for every working adult. Now, so if you have a working couple, you know, $740,000 of additional debt burden on top of their car, their house, their credit cards, student loans, and their share of the state debt, the city debt, municipal water district debt, you know, corporate debt, business debt. We've reached a point where I don't think anybody could pretend, yeah, this is payable. We just need to tighten our belt a little bit. We're past the point of tightening, you know, any belt. Now, I think at the end of the day, there will not be a default in nominal terms. There's no reason for the U.S. government not to have enough paper dollars to pay its debts because it can issue more. Right. So if you can print more, then obviously you'll never default in nominal terms. Now, people are just looking for when's the hyperinflation. I have a different theory. And the hyperinflation that everyone's been predicting, or began predicting certainly in 2009 with incredible, breathtaking response of the Fed to the, you know, then crisis, you know, they were predicting hyperinflation by the end of 2009, which didn't happen because it doesn't work the way they assume. But in my view, what happens is gold withdraws its bid on the dollar. Now, it's a really hard thing. It's easy to say, but it's a paradigm shift because most people think that the dollar is bidding on all assets, including gold. And so some people, very thoughtful people, would say gold is unique. It's the one thing whose offer is withdrawn, not the bid. And what do I mean by this? In times of crisis, it's the bid that goes away. Imagine that the U.S. Geological Survey says there's going to be an earthquake in L.A., 15 on the Richter scale, nothing taller than a dollhouse will be left standing. There would be no bids on real estate, probably from Santiago, Chile, up to British Columbia and as far east as the Mississippi River, but there would be no lack of offers of people happy to sell you their house or their skyscraper at any price, just trying to get out of it, but no bids. Waiting, everybody holding their breath, waiting for the earthquake. When it finally happens, the new bid will come into the market, which got to be a lot lower. And they say, well, gold is the one unique thing. It's not the bid that's withdrawn to buy gold, it's the offer to sell it. Okay, that's because you got it backwards. Gold is the money. Gold is the thing bidding on the dollar and ultimately giving the dollar value, but people don't think of it that way. And so the gold bid will withdraw on the dollar when people realize that gold, excuse me, not all people. Most people are not relevant to this equation. It's only the gold owners. And when the gold owners see that the dollar is hopeless and they withdraw their bid on it, at first you see rising price, everybody's happy, everybody who bought gold is vindicated. Many of them seek to sell some of their gold, ironically, to get more of those dollars that they just said were worthless paper, you know, profit taking, as they call it, which I'm sure is happening right now in large quantities at $4,200. That when gold withdraws its bid on the dollar becomes worthless. And via a process of arbitrages, all commodity prices will go to infinity until people stick a fork in it and say the dollar's done. So probably my most important paper, When Gold Backwardation Becomes Permanent. And I explain what that term is, why this matters, why we've already seen hints of backwardation of permanent. We have backwardation, by the way, right now in silver. So silver is becoming scarcer and scarcer as its price has gone. A very unusual thing, and not the pattern we've seen in many years. It's happening right now in silver, not in gold, but in silver. So I think, at the end, the debt becomes, hopeless. That's when all this happens. I think we have some years yet. I don't think this is today or tomorrow. But, we're playing with fire. This is dangerous stuff.
So why is silver acting the way it is? Is silver primarily money? Is it a utility metal? Is it, does it function still similarly to gold? And what's the future of silver?
Silver has always been the money of the wage earner. So let's say you're a skilled blue collar tradesman. You're taking home, $1,000 a week, something like that. And you want to put 10% of your wage into holding money. Well, gold's not really efficient if you want to buy $100 of it. There's a very wide bid-ask spread. There's a very big premium in manufacturing, tiny little 1 gram, less than 1 gram bars. And it's also not very satisfying. If you see less than a gram of gold, it usually comes in something called a certicard. So it's a size of a credit card with a little plastic window in it. And inside that plastic window, there's a tiny little chip of gold floating around in it. It's not really emotionally, satisfying. $100 worth of silver, 2 ounces, you've got something that has some heft in your hand, some size, you can appreciate. And now, it's only 2 ounces of silver. Was a month or two ago, that would have been 3 or 4 ounces of silver. So, it's the working man who's always turned to silver. And for whatever reason, they are trying to save more, and or the capital owning class, the capital asset class, is saying silver is a relative bargain. But whatever it is, somebody is really bidding up silver, and it's not speculators in the futures market using leverage. That's what our indicator, the basis, is measuring. It's not being bid up in futures with leverage, which is important because those people, it's a quick trade. Stab into the market, stab out. There's cost of holding that leverage and obviously extreme risk playing with 20-to-1 leverage. When people buy metal, they're just taking it home, and then it's not necessarily coming back to market for a few years or whenever. So that's happening right now. So silver is a dual, there's definitely a lot of industrial applications for it, because at $50 an ounce, it's a hell of a lot cheaper than gold. Very little industrial use, if anything, that's $4,000 an ounce. And I imagine that everybody is re-engineering all their manufacturing processes to use even less gold now. That's gone up. It's basically more than doubled in 2 years. So, if you're manufacturing semiconductor circuit boards, you're starting to think about substituting something else for gold, because it's become, cost prohibitive. But anyway, so silver has that dual nature, but right now it is somebody's bidding the hell out of it. And my guess would be it's not solar panels and antibacterial countertops today.
We talk about credit event, or I don't know if what kind of black swan events that you would anticipate tipping us over the edge, but you were talking about the end, if you will, being a couple of years away. So why do you differ from others who would say that it's just around the corner? First of all, do you see interest rates continuing to decline inevitably? And where does that leave us in the interim before it crashes? And then where does gold fit in on the other side?
Yeah, I see interest rates continuing to decline, because there's no productive borrower who can afford, or very few. The marginal borrower is not profitable at today's interest rate. So before interest rates were going up, on our own podcast, we did a series for October, whatever year that was, that we called Zombie Month, And so zombie's a term. This wasn't coined on some dank corner of the internet. It was coined by the Bank for International Settlements. And a zombie corporation has a debt, and the debt service, the interest payment, is less than their profit. Now, why is this important? Because it takes profits in order to pay debt. And if your monthly interest payment is $1 million and your profit is $500,000, you're sinking deeper into debt. And this is only possible due to, low interest rates and very forgiving creditors and credit markets. So that was before interest rates went up. 20% of all corporate debt out there was zombie debt. That's a pretty severe number. Now, we went from essentially 0% on the Fed funds rate to essentially 5.25%. During that time, none of these companies became more profitable with COVID and all the restrictions and green energy restrictions, a lot of other things, and now tariffs. If anything, they became a lot less profitable, but the cost of the debt service, jumped by 7 or 8 percentage points because these are lower quality debts. And not only did the interest rate go up, but their spread of junk bonds to treasuries went up by several percentage points. So they're looking at 7 or 8% higher interest rate than they had before, which means that a whole heck of a lot more companies that weren't zombies back in, October of 2021 are zombies, to the current regime. And you can only keep kicking that can down the road. So far, I think we've kind of hit that point. And even the Fed is responsive to it. I don't think Powell wanted to cut rates, but we've had two cuts so far, I think, sort of hinting at more. Obviously, Trump wants, zero, which is a whole different thing, but Powell trying to play by the traditional central bank playbook, reluctant, but kind of doing it, I think is forced. I think he's looking at the credit market saying there's very little appetite or for that matter, capability to service debt at these rates. If you want to prevent mass defaults, which means, mass banking system defaults, bankruptcies among banks, you've got to lower the rates. And I think that's what he was looking at. So I think that's going to happen. It's happening in the rest of the world where the politics are different. Let's say Switzerland. It's not as contentious between the head of state and the head of the central bank. They're already back to negative again.
All right. So you got Trump, you got Powell, you got Wiener. Let's say we put Wiener in for you're the president or the, you're making a decision for the Fed. So what are you doing differently?
So I want to caveat that with, I would never, ever want the job of head of the Fed.
I put you in myself for this podcast. So I want to know what Wiener would do differently to solve our problems.
Because I don't think the Fed should exist, and I don't think there is any good, answer. So it's a matter of paying now versus paying. It's really a matter of paying now versus paying later. And the more you postpone the pain, the greater the pain is. But if you take it now, it's going to be pretty darn great. So if you want to keep the system going, if you want another few kicks at that can, you got to lower the interest rate. Now, that said, so don't say Wiener said lower the interest rate. That will have all sorts of harmful effects. But if you want to keep things going, you don't want the system to blow up right now, that's what you would do.
So we just basically kick the can further is we, that's the only thing we know how to do.
Kicking the can further. That's right. That's our choice.
Put it on for our kids, right? So which economies right now would you say are most exposed to a monetary credit shock?
It's as always, it's the peripheral economies. The whole monetary system of the world centers around the U.S. for a variety of historical reasons. It's really a dollar world. There's something approaching $250 billion worth of derivatives, mostly interest rate and foreign exchange swaps. The dollar is 99%. One side, at least one side of 99% of those. I mean, it's really the dollar, and the other countries have their local paper script, and they try to manage their exchange rate with the dollar by mucking around with the interest rate, and they get the short end of the stick, is basically how it is. And I think you're going to see some, what people would consider to be relatively big peripheral currencies, blowing up. We could be watching, you know, Argentinian currency blowing up right now. That one's a basket case anyway. But we'll start with the basket cases. Eventually, it will run through all the other currencies. That's why I say we got years left. The U.S. dollar will be the last. It will blow up. It will fail. But it will fail last after all the others. So that means after the euro, after the pound, after the yen, after the yuan, every currency that people might favor or think is good will fail first, including the Swiss franc. But we're not there yet, but you could see a failure of, obviously, the Argentinian peso, Turkish lira. There's another one that looks wobbly right now. Boy, does the Japanese yen, long the widowmaker trade, is looking really wobbly. And who knows what's going to happen? And you mentioned black swan earlier. I think one of the hedge fund managers coined the term, there's a flock of black swans, you know, waiting for us. And it's anybody's guess as to which one of them launches first, but you know, there's a whole host of them that are coming home to roost.
I mean, with central banks like buying gold or maybe dumping the dollar, if you will, do you see that trend continuing? Do you see it continues? I'm guessing that's should be translated as a lack of confidence in fiat rather than just diversification. Now, do you see in the future some sort of tethering back to a gold standard? Could a new monetary policy like the BRICS challenge the dollar dominance in the near future? Or is it just in the fiat currency altogether?
So I differ from everybody else in how I look at all these things. When you see a China, for example, selling dollars, you know, they maintain a currency peg, which means that when people want to buy your currency, you have to issue more. And when people want to sell your currency, you have to buy your currency back by selling dollars. And so in the ferocious rush to dump the Chinese yuan by the Chinese people, the Chinese People's Bank of China is obliged to buy their currency back to prevent it from utterly crashing. So no, I do not see this as a lack of confidence in the dollar. I see this as the destruction of trust of the yuan. So I'm interpreting it exactly the opposite way of most of the gold people. Now, central banks are buying some gold, but when you there's a graph that's been going around showing that the gold holdings of the central banks has surpassed their treasury holdings for the first time in many years. That is largely due to the incredible skyrocketing price of gold. And at the same time, with rising interest rates from 2022, a big drop in the price of treasuries. So treasuries, if you have long-dated treasuries, fell 25% roughly. In the same time, gold has, you know, more than doubled since 2022. So that's just simply the math of, you know, calculating on a mark-to-market basis. Yeah, the central banks are buying some gold for a variety of reasons. I think they think the price is going to go up. But in terms of, is anybody going to want to go to a gold standard? No, because their central bankers are educated in the same universities as our central bankers. They're all Keynesians. They all believe in irredeemable currency. None of them believe that gold, you know, should be, you know, use this money. And of course, a gold standard doesn't have a central bank. So that none of them want to just wind themselves down, give up their power, you know, close the building, you know, close, turn off the lights, close the door, and hand the keys over to, you know, whatever, and walk away. They want to keep the game going, you know, as long as they can. So no, I don't think so. The problem is, if you look at BRICS, that's like an attempt to build a euro. Only whatever commonalities may or may not exist between Italy, Germany, France, Spain, Greece, et cetera, which is say they're not, you know, if you talk to somebody in Europe, they don't say I'm a European. They say I'm French. In fact, in Italy, they often don't say I'm Italian. They say I'm Piedmontese, I'm Milanese, I'm Venetian, right? Because, you know, the regions were artificially pasted together, you know, not too long ago, and they still remember their region. But they don't think of themselves as Europeans. There are massive differences culturally between Germany and the others, or Italy and the others. And then to artificially, you know, quilt a currency together from these disparate countries, it's kind of doomed, you know, from the start. But now if you look at the BRICS, Brazil, what do they have in common with Russia? What does that have in common with India?
They don't like the dollar. They don't like the dollar. That's the common.
They don't like the dollar, right? But you don't really have a uniting principle if the only thing you have is you don't like something else. That's not going to, you know, stick together too good. So, you know, for a while, Russia was selling oil to India and accepting payments in rupees. And I think it was a stunt where they wanted to show, see, we can be past the dollar. And then the Russian finance minister eventually stood up and said, we're not going to do this anymore. We're not going to continue to accumulate a, and this was his term, pile of useless rupees. Now, of course, India has capital controls. There is no market for rupees outside of India because of the government's policy. Same thing with yuan, same thing with Russian rubles, same thing with South African rand. These countries have capital control because they're desperately afraid that if their people were allowed to, they'd dump their currencies and get dollars. So, which is number one, but that means the currency is useless. You can never use it as a reserve currency because you can't really get them outside the borders and they have no value or use outside the borders. So, you know, yes, they would like an alternative to the dollar. No, none of their other currencies are going to work. No paper currency is going to work. One thing would work, which is gold, but ain't nobody want that. So that's where the
no
world
one wants
is today.
To get rid of the printing. No one wants to give the printing press away.
They want the power over their people. That's right, because they think it's giving them extra, you know, free goodies. So it's a very perverse world. You know, gold is the one thing that would work. It's the one thing that they don't want or think they want. None of them can retroactively declare their currency to be a gold deposit. Their people don't trust their own governments. You know, whatever distrust you could say Americans have for the U.S. government, man, do we trust our government compared to how Indians trust their government, Chinese trust theirs, Russians trust theirs, et cetera.
So we're not alone, is what you're telling me, Keith.
I'm sorry?
We're not alone, is what you're saying.
That's right.
Keith, what's your take on central bank digital currencies? Evolution, entrenchment, what is it?
I think logical progression. So, you know, we're at a point, as I said, where I think interest rates are going to tip negative. Maybe in the U.S. dollar just yet, but certainly in the rest of the developed world. And if they're negative enough, people will withdraw the currency from their bank accounts and take home paper cash. That is really, for the first time since the 1930s, a run on the bank. And that's what they thought, that they had put a penny in the fuse box by making currency irredeemable. You can't have a run on the bank. There's no point. If the interest rate's too low, there's no point in withdrawing your cash because cash is zero. But if the interest rate goes negative, cash is zero, and zero is better than negative. Right? If I have $1,000, I'm looking at getting $990 back from the bank. Maybe I just have $1,000 in crisp 20s under the mattress. I don't have that loss. Now, if it's only, you know, 1%, yep, I'm not sure how many people would withdraw their cash. But as the rate continues to sink negativer and negativer, coin a word there, there's a point at which there'll be a mass exodus, and that'll be run on the banking system. So the way you know, the whole methodology of the welfare regulatory state is the government does something, interferes in the economy, causes some distortion. People complain about the distortion, and the fix is another intrusion. And then that causes some other problem, and then the fix is yet, you know, another intrusion. That's how we have built this, you know, system. So when negative rates, you know, drive people to do that, then there's going to be central bank digital currencies, and that's how they're going to wall people in. Okay, well, there's no point in a run because the cash, you know, so we want a paper cash, we'll have digital cash, and digital cash will have the same negative interest rate as the deposit rate, and therefore there's no reason to move your, you know, move your cash. So I think that's coming. A lot of people cite like how much more control it will give them over your life and how much more visibility. If you use credit cards, they already have it anyway. There's nothing that they can do with CBDCs they can't already do with Visa and MasterCard, you know, if they want to. Now in the U.S., they're not really doing social credit schemes and, you know, carbon restrictions and whatever, but they certainly could. They can see your whole purchase history with Visa, you know, who you're paying, if you're paying by check. If you do everything by cash, no, but every once in a while, some hacker types try to completely leave the grid and become invisible. That's actually much harder than most people think, unless you're really educated and incredibly dedicated. You're leaving digital footprints all over the place. They absolutely know where you are, what you're doing, what you're spending on. And so I think CBDCs are the fix for negative interest rate, which I think are coming.
People, yeah, it's what's the George Orwell book?
1984.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at.
Hopefully not. Hopefully, you know, the voters just say enough is enough.
Well, I'm curious as to how you compare and view gold versus crypto. Some people say that Bitcoin is like digital gold. Do you see the gold standard and crypto camp being far off? Do you see them coexisting, or do you see some way to technology enhancing gold's role, and what's that look like?
So I just have to smile when people say Bitcoin is digital gold. You know, I'll put it this way, and you can quote me on this. Bitcoin is obviously superior to gold at skyrocketing, also crashing.
You mean so volatility?
It's an incredible, right, volatility is a feature, not a bug. And if you want to create intergenerational wealth in a month, buy Bitcoin at the right moment. It's incredible for doing it. But there's nothing to do with being money. It's not money. And that point to gold is being boring. That's right. Money should be boring. It should be the last thing that you want to think about. You're constantly checking your phone. Does my money go up or down? Money is the altimeter against which all other things are measured as to whether they're going up or down. So no, I don't think it's anything like gold. I had a debate. I was invited to debate against a guy named Pierre Rochard at the Soho Forum, which is sponsored by the Beeson Foundation. And it was a, you know, gold versus Bitcoin debate. I'll give you the punchline. Yeah, I won by landslide. And it's on YouTube. Everybody, you know, who's interested in this should watch, you know, the argument. But essentially, the volatility precludes it from being used as savings, and also precludes it as for use as capital. No business could borrow Bitcoin because its value is too unstable. So when Monetary Metals, we issued a gold bond a couple years back, and we put out an article, Gold 1, Bitcoin 0, comparing, so Coinbase had recently issued a bond to finance their growth. It was $1 billion. And so the leading crypto company financed themselves in dollars. Not telling, right? They don't even eat their own dog food. And Monetary Metals, we financed ourselves in gold. We're eating our own dog food, which in the technology world, which is where I came from originally, you know, to dog food was actually made into a verb. Any company that wasn't dog fooding its own product, you kind of say, what's wrong with the product? Why are they not using their own thing? And so you can't use Bitcoin for either of those purposes, which means that it's a volatile asset that goes up and down. Could it be $1 million? Yeah, it could. I will not take the position that because it's not money, therefore its price has to go zero. It could go to $1 million. Could go to $10 million. I don't know. And neither do the promoters. You know, every time that Bitcoin peaks, the day before it peaks, the promoters are predicting, you know, orders of magnitude higher prices. And then you see a 79% drawdown. They don't know either. I have no shame in me admitting I have no idea where the price is going to be next. Will it be under 100,000? Will it be over 200,000? Yeah, maybe, probably. Mm.
I had somebody on here who said, soon enough, everyone's going to be a millionaire, and the price of a can of Coke is going to be $20. I mean, it's just crazy how this, you can't keep kicking the can and think it's not going to blow. And what I hear you saying is that we can only kick the can so much further. We're near that tipping point. And so you've been a big gold advocate for a while. You've got a monetarymetals.com business that you started. If you can tell us more about that, I think it's a fascinating concept. Can you tell us more about what that's all about?
So we set out to solve the problem that people need a way of saving and accumulating compounding interest in savings in a, we'll just say, form of money that's not subject to debasement. So, you know, today, if you're getting 4% in a bank account, I think you'd be lucky if you were. But how fast is the dollar losing its value? Nobody can define that precisely, but it might be losing its value faster than 4%. So it's kind of like you're on a treadmill, you're running at 4 miles an hour, but unfortunately the treadmill is moving you backwards at 4.2 miles per hour. You're not really getting anywhere. So we set out to solve that problem by saying, okay, people need a way to save and compound real interest so that by the time you get to, let's say, 65 and you want to retire, you actually have the means with which to retire, and you know, your savings aren't devalued into a joke. It turns out with the rising price today, we're actually solving another problem as well, which is people have bought gold all along the way. So if you got involved in gold post 2008 financial crisis, which is when I got in, you bought gold somewhere around, you know, $1,000 plus or minus. Okay, so now gold is 4,200. What do? Well, you bought gold because you didn't like the dollar. So how do you profit from your gold other than by selling it and getting dollars? Which doesn't, if it made sense to buy gold in the first place, it makes sense to continue to hold it. And by the way, there's a huge capital gains tax waiting for you if you bought it at 1,000 and you sell it at 4,200 to rob you of much of that gain. Now, if you, you know, deposit that up with us and earn interest on it, now you can profit from it, even at today's, you know, much higher prices, without having to sell. So that's our proposition in a nutshell. And how do we do this? We're using the gold productively. We're not one of these crypto plays where it's like looping and, you know, we take it and we lend it to somebody else and they're betting on a higher price. And the thing that they're betting on is the collateral. And then they're lending it to somebody else and it just loop, 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 loop. And then when the price goes down, the whole thing is liquidated and, you know, $30 billion worth of value is vaporized, you know, in a few hours. We are leasing the metal to productive businesses such as jewelers that need metal in the business as inventory. And so they have to finance that somehow. If they finance it in dollars, there's all this price risk. Imagine borrowing $1 million and you buy $1 million worth of gold jewelry. Okay, great. If the price of gold drops 10%, now you have a $900,000 asset, but you still owe $1 million liability. You're insolvent. And the bank can shut you down, take everything, liquidate, you know, collateral, you're done. So, which means they have to hedge. Now, hedging means borrow $1.25 million, buy $1 million worth of jewelry, put $250,000 in a brokerage account, and short gold futures on margin. If the gold price goes up, then the bank says, please put up more cash, increase your margin. That's a real problem if the gold price doubles over 2 years, which it has, and they've all been banging their heads against margin calls. So we come along and say, look, we'll lease you the inventory, no margin calls, no issues with whether the price rises or falls. It's not your problem because it's not your asset. You don't own it. It's not on your balance sheet, not available to your creditors if you go bankrupt. It belongs to the gold investors who are happy to own that price risk because they bought gold anyway. And now they're getting a 4% yield versus paying 0.75% for storage. So that's what we do. That's how it works. You know, obviously, there's a lot more detail. People want to understand the risks, insurance, this, that, the other thing. But that's the summary in brief.
So it's earning interest on gold, paid in gold.
Paid in gold.
I mean, you believe gold is the currency, and you earn a gold yield, and so you don't get paid in dollars as the interest rate. You get paid in gold.
Your stack of gold grows. Rather than shrinks. So I saw there was a gold company recently that announced they have a gold decumulation program. I was like, well, that's a good word for it. So they said, okay, suppose you give us $100,000 to buy gold, and then every month we give you a dividend as long as the gold price is going up. You can still keep $100,000 worth of gold, and we keep sending you free money. Yeah, sure, that's because you're selling your gold stack. So, yes, you still have 100,000 worth of gold. 100,000 worth of gold today is half as much gold as it was, you know, 2 years ago, right? So decumulation, yeah, that's a good word for it. Who wants to decumulate their savings during their, you know, working life, or even while you're retired, right? That then you're living in fear that you're going to outlive your money. And you know, in days, you know, hundreds of years ago, when there was no way to deposit, usury was illegal. There was no way to earn interest. People would accumulate, let's say, silver, you know, their whole working life until they couldn't work anymore, and then they had to sell bits of silver, right, to buy groceries. And they were desperately afraid of what happens if I run out of money and I'm still alive. Well, then you become the beggar on the church steps. That's what happens, or happened in those days. Nobody wants to be in that position. So if in retirement you can live on the interest without liquidating the principal, now you've got something. And of course, that was part of what got us out of the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, and what made, you know, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, you know, so great was, yeah, you could live on the interest. What a concept. And we had that through arguably, you know, the great inflation of the 1970s really put a dent in, and then the collapsing interest rate post 1981. You know, so when I started my career, effectively the end of the 1980s, the standard advice was, but this was lingering from, you know, what had been before, set aside 10% of your salary and put it into something really conservative, like bank CD. And by the time you get to 65, you have whatever it was at that time, $1 million in savings. And that's enough to live on and have the median lifestyle in retirement. Presumably you have the median lifestyle while you're working. Okay, great. The interesting thing is, of that $1 million, something like 85% of that was the compounding of interest, and only 15% was the broad, like, set aside from your salary. So you need that compounding. And if you don't have the compounding, there's just no way, you know, you look at your goals and they're a million miles away. It's like those mountain peaks behind you. You know, if you're actually in these mountains marching there, you discover those mountain peaks are a lot farther away than you think. You're not really making a hell of a lot of progress on foot getting to that peak right behind your head. And that's, you know, how people feel about their retirement saving. It's like, okay, you know, life is pretty good and we have iPhones, lattes, and we have all these things. You know, life is wonderful, but you can't save to a significant goal. So people turn to speculation. What asset do you want to bet on today? You want to bet on Bitcoin, you want to bet on this, bet on that. And if you're right and you're nimble and you get in at the right time, get out at the right time, you can make a killing. The problem is whole generations can't make that killing. Most of them are going to be on the losing side. A few of them are going to be big winners. But of course, the media celebrates the big winners, doesn't celebrate millions of losers. And, you know, it doesn't work. You need production to finance savings ultimately. And so that's the economic problem.
A friend of mine said, man made money, God made gold. Which do you trust? And supposedly the Wolf of Wall Street took that from him. So you have a very interesting concept where you save in gold, where you make money in gold, where you retire in gold. So that's very powerful, especially if in this world of chaos, and I don't think gold's going away anytime soon. I agree with you. Gold is, I don't know what the word you use, boring, but I like boring right now.
That's what you want. You want it to be boring.
Awesome. Keith, if people want to find you, either follow you, got questions, want to visit your website, if you can tell us how we can do that.
Monetary-metals.com. On Twitter, I'm at Real Keith Wiener. That's KEITHWEINER. There are imposters that love to misspell my name and try to siphon off, you know, the traffic. But I do post, you know, a few times a day usually.
Well, Keith, enjoyed it. Hope to have you back. I learned a lot. Had fun. And hope that our listeners will benefit as well. And if you've found this beneficial, please rate comments. Keith Wiener's information will be on the bottom of the video. And thanks again for listening. Keith, thanks so much. Be in touch.
Thanks for having me.